It's the Ag Watcher Show. It's the Ag Watcher Show. It's the Ag Watcher Show.
G'day, my name's John Hassell. I'm the President of the WA Farmers Federation, Vice President of the National Farmers Federation, sheep and crop farmer in Pingelly, Western Australia, farmer, pushbike rider when I get time, and guitar maybe when I get a bit of time. So dueling banjos may be something that could happen one of these days, Matt. father of three and grandfather of nearly six.
Jeez, I've got a trove.
I was going to say it's a Renaissance man, does everything. Huh? It's like having Leonardo da Vinci on the thing, guitar player and, you know. Speaking of the band, there you go.
He was a perfectionist. I'm just a jack of all trades, master of none.
Speaking of banjo stuff, I've actually just made my own little banjo out of a chocolate tin, you know, like the round chocolate tin you get, favourites. I've used that as a resonator and I've just got to string it up now and it should be right to go. So I'll be showing.
It will be not right to go because a banjo is terrible when it's professionally made. Never mind when it's made out of a chocolate tin.
Well,
a banjo, this is controversial. A banjo makes the bagpipes sound good.
That's probably
true. Just happen to love them both.
Yeah, no, there you go. So it must be, I think it's like Vegemite. You either like it or you don't. So,
mandolin is what you should get, Matt.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. It's Andrew, not many people know this, John, but Andrew played the mandolin as a child. I said to him, all we need is a fiddle player and we've got a bluegrass band happening.
Well, if we're going to get fiddle player, we might as well get Michael Jackson. Right on.
That's going to get a suit from his estate.
I was going to say, he can't sue you when he's dead.
Let's get into it. Let's get into the sixth sense. So we're going to give you, John, a couple of statements or words, and you give us the first thoughts that come into your head. It can be as short as a one answer, or it can be... we'll give you 30 seconds for each answer maximum before the computer cuts you off. Matt is our trained economist, so he is going to keep count so we can count up to six.
That was the first course you did in economics, was learning how to count.
Would you get to 10?
In summer with you, and if you had Crocs weren't invented then, but if you had summer and thongs on, you could go to 20.
How could you go to 20 with webbed feet?
Yeah, you can still see the individual bones in the webbed feet.
Toenails.
Okay. So it's 10 fingers and thumbs and two toes.
Yep, that's it.
Righto, Matt.
I'll start. Fighting fund.
It's an interesting fund. It's there for legal actions, I believe, and not for political stuff, which some people in WA think is a bit disappointing because of the potential for fighting the ban on the live sheep trade.
National Farmers Federation.
Well, Australia's peak agricultural body, and it's made up of state farming organisations and it's only about 18 members, and I think it should stay that way, and we shouldn't be encouraging direct memberships like a lot of organisations have done, because I think it would dilute the effectiveness of the organisation.
Haggis.
Never tried it. Sounds awful, but I'm told by blokes like Andrew that it's okay. So maybe one day when I've got a lot of beer.
Sheep product as well. So, you know, using the whole animal, supporting your...
Well, shanks used to be given to the dogs and the flaps used to be given to the dogs, and now they make roll roasts and very expensive meals at restaurants. So maybe haggis one day might become something like that, Andrew.
I think so. if we put the right work behind it, if the National Farmers Federation supported it properly, then maybe we've got an option there. And you're the vice president, so maybe that can be a job for you. Crocs.
Well, it's got to come through the state farming organisations, Andrew. Crocs footwear. Well, I booted a ball for a dog once and was wearing Crocs, and I missed the ball and hit the ground and tore the end off my toe, so I've never worn them since. Oh,
the dog was wearing Crocs, or you were wearing Crocs?
Yes.
Matt.
Live sheep export, John.
Oh, very vexed issue, this one. I've got news reports here from the 22nd of May, oh, sorry, the 7th of May 2022, where Albanese said he's not going to ban it, reiterated it again on the next day, and then their policy changed. And I think, you know, we should absolutely be holding him to it, that it's not going to be banned. It's a viable industry. People keep saying it's worth 80 or 90 million. Others say it's worth 135 million. With a multiplier effect of 3 to 4, that could be anywhere from 320 million through to $1 billion to the Australian economy. Too stupid to throw that away.
Climate change.
Well, from my perspective, I think climate change is something that everybody wants to, but it's a bit like the emperor's new clothes to a great extent, and we're going to be forced into all sorts of situations. And my perspective is that we've got to get the best possible deal that we can for farmers out of that.
Here we go.
Is that six?
Yeah, that is six. I thought you were going to say biosecurity level. There's so many things talk about. There's so many things to talk
about. Sorry, biosecurity tax, did you say? Biosecurity tax.
It's not the 7 cents.
It's not the 7 cents. We might come to it anyway.
We don't have enough computing power to do six questions.
Yep.
To do seven.
There's a lot to go on here.
I was going to start off, actually, I had a question. You mentioned about direct memberships of NFF. Is that something that people are considering? And what do you mean by that, direct memberships?
Oh, look, I think there are people who do direct memberships to Cattle Council, to sheep producers, wool producers, and I think that, well, I know there's been an application in the past for direct memberships to the NFF, and I think it should go through the state farming organisations. You know, NFF has done a great job in taking over, you know, numbers of lobbying issues from the state farming organisations, and it means that WA Farmers is a very lean, mean fighting machine with only a few staff. We're very effective, I think. And I think that if you start diluting the WA Farmers, New South Wales Farmers models with direct membership to the NFF, then we lose the ability to raise our own membership, and we then are unable to fight the state fights that we need to fight. So I think it's pretty important that the NFF remains as it is, which is a peak body of peak bodies.
Okay. No, so I was curious as to what you meant there. That clears that up. Because obviously you've got like the peak bodies, like sheep producers, wool producers and whatnot, because they used to be, they never used to exist in the past. They used to be councils of like the NFF, didn't they? Is that true?
Oh, yeah, I think they were, but you know, for some reason we, you know, Cattle Council has became Cattle Australia. They had a different name earlier, and they've changed to Cattle Australia now. You know, so there's all sorts of iterations out of it. And look, you know, you saw it in Queensland a few years ago. They had a splinter body, you know, or rather the two bodies came together, all the bodies came together, and then you got a splinter body. And I think that's, you know, there's democracy is going to always throw those things up. But, you know, if we can do democracy well within our base organisations, which we're trying very hard to do in WA Farmers, then I think if you can get the democracy right there, then it should flow through to the other organisations.
Hey, John, you know a bit about politics and lobbying, obviously, your background. Do you think there's too many organisations?
That was my question. I was going to say, like, I'm just thinking about all the organisations, grain growers, grain producers, sheep producers, wool producers, alpaca association. There's like
goat industry.
I think AFI did a report a couple of years ago, and it identified dozens upon dozens of different organisations representing fairly niche sort of parts, and each of those have got a CEO and an EO and whatever else. Do you think there's too many, or?
Well, yes, I do, because I think if they get the democracy right amongst all the organisations, and then and the NFF is a peak of peaks, a proper peak of peaks, and we can get the streamlining right. You know, people say this is not about saving money, it's not about sacking people. Well, you know, actually, we should bite the bullet and say yes, it is about actually getting efficiency, and that means reducing the number of chief executive officers, because you don't have to pay chief executive officer for every little thing that's on the planet. I think that we need to streamline that, because there's a lot of cost in doing all that sort of thing, and there's a lot of stuff that's replicated, a huge amount of stuff that's replicated on each of these councils. And I think, you know, and you know, Andrew, you're only too well aware of this. You've got Grain Growers Limited and Grain Producers Australia. The two organisations vying for the, you know, the representative organisation for the GRDC. And, you know, they have been at each other's throats. And I think they're working well together at the minute. But, you know, ideally, we'd have one. And it would be proper democracy. And I don't think that that happens at the minute. I think one's, you know, self-appointed. And I think the other one's democratic. And I'm probably going to get shot for saying that, but the reality is that it's not as democratic as it could be. And I think we need to be able to make sure that that happens. And, you know, if you get away from the proper democracy of it, then you get individuals having huge amounts of influence. And, you know, people get cheesed off with that. They walk away, throw their hands in the air. And, you know, we've seen it in WA year after year after year. People say, I'm not joining the organisation because you've got WA Farmers on one hand and PGA on the other. Well, we're working really well together at the moment, best we've ever done, I think. And I think between us, we'll get some good results.
Well, I guess with PGA and WAF, like there's always, like I remember when I was in West Australia, 2010 to 2015, there was a lot of talk about joining them, and there was a lot of differences of opinion on a lot of things. It seemed like in the newspapers, if one had one opinion, the other had to have the opposite opinion. That's the way it sort of seemed. But then, like, you've got sort of different causes like the GM canola, where they're pretty much in agreement with one another. And live export, I'm pretty sure that PGA and WAF are pretty much on the same
realign,
the same views on that. So I think it's fine to have organizations with different views, but there's going to be overriding issues that affect all farmers, regardless of their persuasion. So,
well, I think if we're honest about, and both groups are honest about the results that they've had in the past, you know, AWI or the reserve price scheme, you could say that PGA was right on that, and the wheat regulation, they were right on that. But, you know, we were definitely right on the CBH thing, keeping it as a cooperative, and their members absolutely told them that. So collectively, we've had some good outcomes. And, you know, and it's taken retrospectivity, for want of a better word, to acknowledge that with PGA. But the reality is that we've got better outcomes because there's been a good, sound, reasoned and robust debate. And the cornerstone of democracy is sound, reasoned and robust debate. Now, if you don't have that debate, you don't get good outcomes. And I think we've had good outcomes because we've had that debate.
When it comes to, like you said before, there's a few organisations where you're representing the one commodity and there's multiples of them. It does, you know, like, it's fair enough if you've got sheep producers and Cattle Australia, you know, different kind of, you know, even though they're both red meat, they're subsets of different sectors type things. So, and subject to different, you know, factors, some overlap here and there, but there are, you know, it makes sense to have that. Whereas when it's the one broad commodity, it kind of does seem like a bit of a double up.
Yeah, look, and there's definitely lots of double up right across the whole of the country. And I think if we can look at that and try and work out how we get efficiencies out of it, because there's a dwindling pot of money. You know, I think COVID, while it wasn't fun being stuck at home for a lot of people, that didn't really affect me terribly badly on my farm because I just got on with the job. But, it, you know, it's brought about this kind of meeting, for instance. We've got a Zoom meeting that's working really nicely here, and I'm not having to jump on a plane as Vice President of the National Farmers Federation and go over. I haven't been over there yet as Vice President. I'm going over in next month because we're doing all our meetings by Zoom and by telephone. And,
there is disadvantages to that, though, John.
Make no mistake, you still need face-to-face.
You don't get a nice steak and a bowl of red wine. And like, that's what Matt and I miss. We talk to each other every day. But, you know, we don't get the opportunity to, you know, have a nice rare steak and, you know, some sweetbreads and some red wine. And
at San Telmo.
The Ag Watch is buying you a bottle of red wine when you go out to dinner. Absolutely. I miss that, sure.
We only buy bags of wine, not bottles.
Goon bags. But, you know, there's been a huge amount of saving, cash saving, by not having to do all that sort of stuff. But nonetheless, there is still, and there always will be, a pressure on your cost structure. So we need to make it a lot more efficient. We need to try and, you know, streamline it as much as possible. Use Zoom when necessary, but you absolutely have to have the face-to-face stuff as well and the goon bags. And I think, you know, there's a lot of savings to be had. So, you know, if we can streamline it, make it more efficient and maintain the democracy, I think we should be aiming for that.
I think we asked DJ about this as well when he was on in January. The one of the big things in lobbying, like we're doing lobbying in Australia, sort of the diplomatic way of talking to parliamentarians, lobbying, etc. I think DJ actually spoke about that at the Alice Springs conference the other day. I saw some tweets on that. But if you look to Europe, where government intervention in agriculture is just all pervasive, and I always laugh when I see farmers in Australia complaining about the government here. I'm like, yeah, go to France or the Netherlands and then see what government intervention is really like. What do you think about all that over there, all those sort of protests that we're seeing, which has been, I reckon that's been since at least September, like large-scale protests almost constantly, in at least somewhere in Europe.
It's been huge, and I think there are people who are inspired by that to want to do it here. You know, we just saw the Extinction Rebellion people who glued their hands to the bridge in Melbourne be thrown in jail. I'm not sure that there's too many cockies really can afford that or want that. So we have to be very careful about how we do go about it. And I think, you know, while there's a lot of people fairly desperate about where things are at the moment, we haven't got to the point of blockading the city to the point where it's going to piss a lot of people off really badly. I think, you know, we've been having a discussion about how we go about, you know, getting a group together to target marginal electorates across the country. You know, now obviously PGA and WA Farmers both come out and said that under our constitutions we can't do that, but we'd sure as hell support it. And you know, there's been discussions about how we go about it. So, you know, that's our preferred option at this stage of the game.
Yeah, do you want to elaborate a bit more on that? Because that's what I referred to with that fighting fund at the outset, that there's a proposal there to pull some money together. And it's not to run candidates, is it, John? It's actually to, I guess...
Media campaigns.
Target electorates you see might be in kind of at risk for Labor, I guess, or to try and throw a bit more oomph behind the you know, candidates that are coming up against Labor in those seats. Is that right?
Well, look, there's been numbers of proposals. There's a guy over here reckons he can raise $60 million, and he may well be able to if we can tap into all animal ag industries. I think there's another proposal by, you know, Tony Seabrook thinks that we can raise $6 million. There's another proposal that says raise 1.6 and you can target 17 electorates across the country. Now, Western Australia and Queensland are the bellwether states, and they are, you know, if those five seats in WA fall the way of Labor, it's a Labor government. If they fall the way of Liberal, it's a Liberal government. Excuse me for a sec. Pardon me. So on that basis, then, you know, why would you not target those seats? And so this media campaign that's been put together by someone outside of our organisation and not at our asking, so I just need to clarify that. This media campaign has been put together to target 17 marginal electorates across the country. And, you know, as I said to Murray Watt's staff, you know, we simply can't capitulate on something like the live trade. And we will fight you on the beaches, in the alleys, and at every single shopping centre and every marginal electorate across the country in order to defeat this, because it is so bad for our country. So, yeah, there's a plan to put together to target those marginal seats and to try and topple the government, because that's the only way that we see that we're going to be able to defeat this, because they're simply not listening to us. I don't know if you were sitting there when Murray Watt was questioned at the last NFF Members Council meeting. You know, we put all of the reasoning, all the sound reason and robust debate to him, and he just blankly looked through us and says, we're going to ban it anyway. Now, it's based on a very dodgy deal between the Animal Justice Party and the Greens Party, and, you know, it's a filthy little deal to keep inner city seats for the Labor Party. Based on those preferences, they've made it political. It's going to have to be made political to beat it, and that's an unfortunate fact of life. They've embarked on this game, they've got to suffer the consequences.
John, I saw on social media, I think just yesterday, that Jackie Jarvis, the WA Ag Minister, is going to go across to the UK to rescue the sheep industry by getting more sheep into the UK.
Maybe I should contact her and tell her about the coach house in Dumfries, Airbnb, available for rentals at any time.
Yeah, and
that's a little plug for my mother's Airbnb.
Do they serve food as well? Because maybe they could take a few lamb chops from Australia and just to support. Now, is that, you don't have to worry about the live export space if Jackie's going to go over there and establish a trade into the UK.
A country where people are like genuinely struggling to heat their homes, and electricity is, they could have lamb, but it'd have to be rare because they can't afford the gas to cook it anymore. So
no, this
it's going to have to be lamb tartare.
The problem's going to be solved.
Well, they can take some wool to keep themselves warm as well, Andrew.
You can afford it. Like it's anyway. I'm not going to talk about the politics of the UK and the deteriorating economic conditions there. Fish and chips.
Yeah, so
$9.
So
£9.
Jackie Jarvis could sell carpet wool over there for you guys if you can't afford the good stuff. So look, I think an ag minister, whatever persuasion, should be trying to promote agriculture. Now, you know, Murray Watt says we need to have, you know, more, and Jackie Jarvis follows the same kind of logic on here, that we need to have more onshore processing. We need to do this, we need to do that, so that they can phase the live trade out. I would say, you know, do all those things. And if the live trade fades itself out in the way it's been done in the eastern states, well and good, but don't do it as a political imperative. Do it as an economic imperative, because as soon as you start meddling politically, that's when people get uptight. But, you know, like lots of things that have happened in agriculture in the last, well, forever, really, as soon as it becomes uneconomic to do something, you won't do it. If it's more economic to get it processed onshore, then we'll do it. So, you know, I don't think anybody's got a problem with it happening that way, but phasing it out politically, everybody's got a problem with. So, you know, I think that Jackie Jarvis going and trying increasing our market for meat over there, fantastic, but don't do it because you want to shut down the live trade. Do it because you want to promote agriculture.
I think she's going to China to promote barley as well. I think I read that somewhere.
That's good, but she's not phasing out beer production here, is she?
The government pretty much is with the taxes on beer. It's like, remember that I remember I came to Australia and I used to think beer was expensive here in Australia. Now it's just crazy. It's like $16 a pint now.
Anyway. You're not brewing your own yet, Andrew?
No. I'm just waiting for Matt. Matt's got a still, and he keeps saying he's going to get me a bottle of something.
He actually
gave a bottle of spirits to another president of another state farm organization.
That's true.
And the day before I met him.
Is he no longer president?
And I got nothing. Actually, you did, actually. Matt got me a bottle of a miniature of homemade, what's that, firewater?
Fireball,
which he gave me, and he didn't put the cap on properly, and it leaked all over my bag. So my bag smelled of whiskey and cinnamon.
Your bag.
Squeezing his bag into his mouth.
What I was going to say. So the fighting fund, yeah, there is, the National Farmers Federation have a fighting fund for legal actions, yeah. So that can be used for things like the live export class action from 2011. That can be used for things like that, but it can't be used for political.
Yes, I think it's being used as well for fighting Bungie pumping carbon dioxide into the Great Australian Basin.
Oh, yeah, it's that thing up in Queensland. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, it's Queensland, Northern Territory, Queensland, South Australia and New South Wales, I think. It's quite a large basin.
It's underground anyway. Nobody will see it.
Yeah, so anyway, it is there for those kind of things. But I think it's, you know, unless it became a class action or maybe fighting, and you know, I'm meeting with a constitutional lawyer next week, I hope, to discuss the constitutionality of phasing out the live trade, you know, politically. And, you know, if it came down to it, then there's a possibility there. But, you know, we've got a lot of homework to do before we even start looking, heading down that path.
But you could use it for, like, you could use it for legal advice.
I don't know about advice, but it certainly could be about an action. You know, I've had a very preliminary discussion with the Farmers Fighting Fund, and they say, we'll put something up, and so we've got to do a fair bit of work before we even put something up.
How much is in that fund? 30 million, I think?
See, that I don't know, and I'm not allowed to know.
But that's a separate thing to what we're talking about with regards to the money that you want to raise to challenge these seats. That's a totally different thing, right?
That is a totally different thing. And, you know, I've got to add there that I'm not raising it. Someone else might be, but I'd encourage them to do so.
Do you, like, this might seem abrupt, yeah. But do you think, like, some of those numbers, like 60 million, 6 million, 1.6 million, do you, like, realistically, do you think it would get that money? Because we sort of see that, like, farmers are doing okay the last couple of years as a national sort of farming sort of collaboration. But getting money from farmers for that type of thing has historically been pretty difficult.
Well, we've never seen such an avalanche of issues coming at us, I think, Andrew. It's huge. And, you know, the live sheep trade is only one example, pardon me, where the animal activists are having a crack at us. And it's activism in all sorts of things. You know, we've seen activism for glyphosate. We've seen activism for, you know, all sorts of other things. And we know that the animal activists have also said, and, you know, Mark Harvey Sutton asked the question of Jed Goodfellow when Murray Watt had his briefing with regards to shutting down the live trade. Are you going to target live cattle next? And Jed Goodfellow said, look, we're concentrating on sheep at the minute. And the reality is, you know, he does want to target live cattle next. And they'll go after pigs and they'll go after chickens. And we know very well that if we capitulate on one thing and one thing alone, then the rest of the world becomes open slather to activists and politicians pandering to activists. Now, if we allow that to happen, if we capitulate on that one, then we as an industry are absolutely buggered. And I think that everybody in those industries, glyphosate included, can see that. And I think if we ask for a very small amount, and I mean a very small amount from every farmer, we should have not too much difficulty raising, you know, the 1.6 million, for instance. When I say we, I mean industry.
Mm-hmm. 1.6 is not much for an $80 billion industry.
Well, you know, this is another thing is, you know, I said this earlier, is that people say it's an $80 million industry. Yeah. Well, you're talking about agriculture as a whole, $80 billion. Absolutely.
And this, do you think, like, I was just curious, like, obviously, you know, John, that we've had a lot to do with WAF, VFF over the years. And so, mm-hmm. like, it's interesting. I've seen, like, I used to share an office with WAF back in 2012, back in... Yeah, 2012, 2013. So I've seen it change over the years. Do you think memberships of these organizations have been declining? Just natural attrition, farms are getting bigger, farms are retiring, all that kind of stuff. Do you feel that, like, all these issues at the moment are causing people to rekindle their interest in sort of agri-politics, rekindle interest in sort of SFOs? Because at the end people can't do direct action in reality. Like, it's one person complaining about stuff on social media isn't going to make any difference to the government. You need organizations to actually push that. But, like, the biggest argument I see is, I'm not going to join it because they don't do anything for me. It's that sort of free rider effect. Well, do you think that's changing?
Well, there's definitely a free rider effect, and I do find it challenging when people, you know, ring me up and say, what are you doing about this? I say, well, are you a member? No, I'm not a member. But look, interestingly, Andrew, you know, the runs are on the board. Our membership is increasing and has been increasing for the last 12 months or 18 months. We've got more members. And you know, as you say, there is a 3% decline in farming numbers every year, and it just doesn't seem to be stopping, unfortunately. But our membership's actually increasing, which is, and PGA's as well, which is really quite outstanding, because I think they can see that we are working really bloody hard to try and, you know, work on their behalf.
Do you think in WA there's been an increase? Is that more specific because, you know, if you look back on the last few years, WA's the live sheep trade, you had the change to gun laws, you had, you know, the Cultural Heritage Act, which got overturned at the last minute.
I think it's on
after a podcast with Trevor Whittington the next day.
24 hours later.
Yeah, they decide to listen to common sense. But there was a lot more impacting upon WA farmers specifically. Do you think that's contributed?
Especially last year, yeah.
Yeah, is that contributed to this increase in joining farming representative bodies?
Absolutely, I do. Trevor and I were driving from here to Meriden one day to attend some sort of submission, and we decided to start writing down all of the issues that were coming at us. And within about 2 minutes, we had a list of 12 things, six federally and six state. And I think that absolutely that's having an effect. You know, people are feeling the pain from all of these, you know, progressives pushing their barrows down our bloody throats. And look, it's happening in the eastern states as well. We've got Murray-Darling Basin's a really big one, energy transmission, both, you know, having a really rather large effect on how farmers are feeling. You know, there's lots of issues that are being forced upon us where we feel like we've, you know, we feel a bit toothless. And I'm really pleased to see Dave Johanki when he came out at the his very first speech at, when he became president. You know, absolutely holding, I think, Murray Watt to account for his behaviours, and I think that we need to be a bit more mongrel like that. And I want to see us be probably a lot more mongrel and you know, a targeted campaign if we can do that. You know, from our perspective, constitutionally, then you know we're much more closely aligned to it. That's where I'd like to see us be, because you know we've got this extra membership now, you know, and it helps us survive. You know, it costs money to run these organisations. We've got the extra memberships now. We actually want to show people that, you know, their trust in us was justified.
There's an old saying, John, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. So do you think that the mongrel one works, or do you think that sometimes you need to kind of tread carefully as well and not kind of get people too offside to be able to try and influence them for change?
Well, my dad said to me before he died, well before he died actually, but he said you can start off being a nice guy and then get nasty, but you can't start off being nasty and then get nice. And I think NFF has, you know, while it's been good, you know, being the nice guy for a long time, it's been shown that we're, you know, we're being treated with contempt because we're being the nice guy. And I think it's time to come out and actually, you know, show the nasty side because, well, it's not even been nasty that we're prepared to stand up and fight like hell for our bloody industry.
Apart from live sheep export, what do you think is the biggest issue facing ag for the next 10 years?
Well, it's you know, anti-farming advocacy by all of these other groups. I mean, you know, just live export of sheep is one, but you know, you look at the website of Animals Australia, they're not animal welfare people at all. They're animal activists, and they're vegan activists, and their stated goal is all forms of animal exploitation, and that includes your guide dog and your goldfish, because they're not displaying their natural tendencies. And you know, we've already seen it come into animal welfare laws, where animals have to be able to display their natural tendencies. Now, you know, that simply couldn't work for me as a farmer because, you know, a sheep would have to be able to run away, and I simply can't allow it to run away. I want to catch it to shear it. You know, so, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we've got to, you know, I guess it's about education of the populace is probably our biggest issue, so that we stop these idiots trying to take their, you know, our standard of living away from us. And I'm not talking about me as a farmer. I'm talking about Australia as a whole, because you know, if all of the activists got their way, we'd have no coal mining, we'd have no gas mining, we'd have no iron ore mining, and we'd have no farming, and Australia wouldn't have a standard of living at all.
But we'd be living in a
It'd be like
natural.
Scotland.
Oh, jeez. Scotland has 100% renewable energy. But what I would say is, look, if we got rid of all that stuff, we'd be living in a lovely natural environment, and we'd be happy. I'd be like Matt would be in his natural environment. He'd be running around with a tiny little fig leaf covering his dignity,
Or a chocolate tin banjo
with
covering my
his.
dignity.
You wouldn't have a chocolate tin banjo because you're not going to get cocoa from Africa, and you're not going to get metal. You're going to have a spear, a flint spear, attacking kangaroos and whatnot.
And being eaten by dingoes.
That might be all right. Be Mad Max.
Being eaten by dingoes. So this is the problem we've got, is all these people with this, you know, lovely idealism, you know, seem to forget that there's actually a benefit to the way we conduct our lives at the moment. And sure, it involves processing of animals. You know, that's the way of life. You know, I prefer not to call it slaughter. It's processing of animals, and we do it in the most humane way we possibly can. And we transport them in the most humane way we possibly can. And we've proved that we're doing that. It's better than, you know, the mortality on the ships is lower than on our farms. And we do everything in our power to maintain a low mortality on our farms. So, you know, people, you know, even the vegans, you know, they choose to ignore that, you know, you've got to dig oil up from the ground to be able to make their bloody vinyl shoes. They choose to ignore that you've got to, you know, spray chemicals out to kill insects so that their food can be provided. You know, they're so selective in the way they think and the way they act. And they pick on an idea that they're going to campaign on, and we just happen to be the target to a great extent because we're a very small proportion of the population. And I can guarantee that, and I liken this to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, our very first need is oxygen. We don't
Wi-Fi.
have oxygen, we're buggered. And once you've got oxygen, your next need is water. And if you don't have water, you're buggered. And the next need then is food, so on. And we're so far down Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we're looking for things to be outraged about.
I've got an opinion, yeah. I can't remember where it was. Oh, it was at the thing last Tuesday, the AMIC.
Yeah, the conference in the evening we had at AMIC was like a representative meat industry conference.
Meat industry conference. And it's really interesting because I was listening to people talking around the place about things. I feel like agriculture sometimes gets too frustrated about things that are not going to have an impact. Like everyone was talking about the healthy eating guidelines are changing, which says you must eat less red meat. And then we get really het up about it and we get really annoyed. Oh, I can't believe they're saying we need to eat, you know, 100 grams instead of 200 grams a day of steak. But why do we get frustrated? Nobody reads healthy eating guidelines. Like if the government came out and said you've got to half your meat intake to be healthy, do you think people are actually going to listen to that? Do you think people are actually going to say, oh, actually, yeah, the government said I'm going to have to eat 100 grams of meat instead of 200 grams of meat? If people read healthy eating guidelines, there wouldn't be KFC, there wouldn't be McDonald's, there wouldn't be full fat sugar Coke, there wouldn't be whiskey, there wouldn't be vodka, there wouldn't be heroin, we know, whatever else.
Whiskey.
But that's what I'm saying. We get head up about it. It's like, but it's not going to have any impact really upon demand for red meat. People are not going to say, oh, I better stop eating red meat because the government says that. But then we get frustrated about like these activists saying this, that, and the other. But the activists are a small minority. I know they've got a little bit of influence, but maybe we need to teach the government that their influence is limited because of the fact that the majority of people just want to go to the pub, have a palmy, a couple of beers, or a steak. They don't actually care about this kind of stuff. You've got farming caring about it, activists caring about it, and everyone else in the middle just wants a palmy and a pint, basically. And that's my view. And they want it cheap.
Well, look, I think you're absolutely right. But when you're politically, you know, we're a minority as a farming group, as regional people, we're a minority, and particularly with the live trade, for instance, and the meat one's an interesting one because it's based on climate change, which is another subject I'd really love to go into. But you know, it's the thin end of the wedge. We know that if we capitulate on the live sheep trade, we know that everything else will be up for grabs. And so, to me, I think yes, we absolutely have to hold on to that and fight like hell for it. Even though, you know, we know that 70% of people support the live sheep trade, they probably don't care about it, and you know, not it may or may not influence their vote, but if it's their way of life, it sure as hell might. You know, I think, you know, it's a really interesting point because, you know, I'm sure as hell not going to drop my bloody meat consumption because I grow the damn things and I love lamb roast for lunch every Sunday, and I sure as hell eat more than my 200 grams for that day. But I think the premise on which we're being asked to change all these things is, you know, it's not clear, and it's, you know, take the one you talked about, meat, for instance. You know, it's about climate change. Well, you know, the reality is that the methane produced from livestock is cyclical. It's not carbon being dug up from the bloody ground and introduced into the atmosphere. It's cyclical. So the whole premise of reducing meat production or reducing meat consumption to reduce our gas, apart from the fact that you probably fart a fair bit, Andrew.
Never farted in my life.
I think is flawed. It's horribly flawed. And so, you know, how can you possibly not want to stand up and fight that? Because, you know, they'll move on to the next one if you allow that to get happen.
I'm going to say something.
While most people don't give a shit.
I was going to say something, John. I wrote an article in 20... I'll tell you what, I'm not going to say that I'm like Nostradamus or Nostradamus, whatever he's called. I wrote an article in 2012 all about the issues around ISCC sustainability things for canola, and I said we've got to be very careful of this. 10 years later, I believe a lot of people are concerned about these sustainability schemes. And then I wrote a piece in 2016. I was told at the time that I was wrong for having concerns about ISCC. I was vindicated. But then I wrote another report in 2016, 2017, Matt, about social license and about how there would be a form of incrementalism with social license, that we capitulate to things like, I think I called the article, is sheep in Western Australia the sacrificial lamb for social license? And that was what it was all about, was about the fact that if we accept that live sheep exports have to go, which is, if it has to go, it has to go. I think it'll go eventually anyway, just naturally over time as processing capacity increases. But my view at the time was that that exact same thing as what you're saying is incrementalism. Like, it's live export. I think it'll be long, this more than 10-hour trucking will be the next one. And then it'll be live cattle, pigs, whatever else. It's just an incremental. And every success leads to more success if you're campaigning, in my view. So Animals Australia, for instance, banned live sheep export. They'll do a revenue raising from that. And then that'll give them the money to do the next thing and the next thing. So I was right, because I got told that not agreeing with social license was the wrong way to view things in agriculture, and that social license was the most important thing that we had as an industry. So, Sam?
Well, look, I'd certainly like to read that article, Andrew, because I think that'd be interesting. I'm personally violently opposed to ESG. You know, DEI and ESG are both things that are, you know, a bit more of this incrementalism about more rules and guidelines about how you do things. But, you know, we have huge numbers of environmental laws, huge numbers of business laws that actually govern the way we do things. And this ESG is a methodology by the banks, in my opinion, of them trying to capture the value that's on my farm, for instance, into their balance sheet. And I believe AgForce Queensland has done a AgCare, which is about capturing that back onto the balance sheet of the growers, and I think that's a bloody good thing. I think we need to fight this sort of stuff and say, actually, this value is mine. You can go to hell. You're not putting it on your balance sheet. I'm not interested in your ESG, and we should do this as an industry, because we have more than enough environmental laws and governance over our businesses already without you inflicting this fake rubbish in order to grab my value.
John, you mentioned before Andrew spoke about his social license, but you were saying about, because when Andrew talked about reduction in meat consumption, he referred to the supposed health benefits of reducing your meat consumption. But then you spoke about this theory around reducing meat consumption to reduce emissions. And that's something that if you look at some of the stuff that United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization were putting out a few years back, they were becoming quite anti-livestock for a little bit there and saying, we need to reduce the industry's footprint globally. I'm not sure if you saw, but there was a report that came out late last year from the FAO looking at total emissions of livestock and what would be needed to be done in different aspects of the industry to get to the target they want to get to in 2050 of reduced emissions. They listed about 12, I think, different strategies of what could be done. And actually, the second lowest of all of those is in, the smallest contribution, second lowest contribution was actually change to diet, change your reducing or eliminating or reducing your meat consumption. So even an organisation like the FAO in their own report are acknowledging that change to diet is minuscule. It's actually things like, farm efficiency, breeding, changing to breeding patterns, sequestration of carbon on farms, a whole range of other, animal health, even just, having more healthier animals and more efficient animals is the big ticket items, not change to consumption. So I'm not sure if you've seen that report, but it's probably one that you want to, if you haven't seen, I'll send you a copy of it, because it's kind of making the argument for us already with their own data.
Good. I appreciate that, Matt. Well, look, I would like to say that on this stuff, the IPCC, this is to show just how this is political rather than based on science. The IPCC report, AR6, page 123, says that methane from livestock is overstated by a factor of 3 or 4. That's 300 to 400% overstated. Now, that proves that it's political. So why aren't they coming out and saying, look, we need to put the livestock emissions aside because it's so minuscule compared with everything else? But instead, we're pushing this narrative that we've got to reduce methane emissions from livestock, which is just proving that it's political. And even the federal government has accepted this without kind of question when they say that Australia's emissions are made up of 16 to 17% of our emissions are from agriculture, and 10 or 12% of those are, well, I think it's 13 of those 16% it's a lot higher than that, sorry. It's 70 or 80% of those emissions are from livestock, which means about 10% of Australia's total emissions are from livestock, which the IPCC says has been overstated by 300 or 400%. So Australia is actually and allowing itself to be put over a drum over these methane emissions. I mean, all livestock countries are. You know, New Zealand just did a complete job on itself by introducing a fart tax, for goodness sake. Pleased to say Murray Watt, you know, and here we go, giving Murray Watt a bit of kudos here, sat in our office after he first got appointed as Ag Minister, drank some red wine, sitting on the kitchen table with us discussing methane, and when the New Zealanders came out and said they were going to introduce a fart tax, he said, well, we're not going to do that to our farmers. So he gets it.
I'm going to say, and you can hold me on this, that they'll be talking about introducing a methane tax or carbon tax that farmers have to pay by the early part of the next decade.
Well, sadly, I think you're right, Andrew, and I'm going to continue to fight it and fight it as hard as I bloody well can, as long as my ass points to the ground.
It's interesting, John, because I spend a lot of my time with non-agricultural people. I live in Canberra, so obviously it's a lot of special people in Canberra, I guess you could.
Was just there, having
you turn your head around? I just want to see if there's a man bun there.
No, nearly. He's just there in a Canberra cafe drinking his soy lattes.
No, it's just curls. Just curls for the girls. It's really interesting. I got a friend of mine's who was vegan for 8 years. And absolutely loves a steak.
Now?
Like, loves a steak. Like, more than I love a steak. Like, I'm a big fish man, but just loves a steak. And it's funny because that's somebody who's 8 years of veganism said it was extremely difficult to maintain that diet of veganism just because it's hard to create meals one after the other that are vegan. And it's hard to go out for restaurants and stuff like that. So I think the number of people who actually stay vegan are pretty slim. And all these sort of fake vegan meats. Like, I don't mind vegan food. Like, if it's veggies and a curry, but when it's these sort of fake meats, that's where I think that's where the issue is, because that's all processed gunk. The Soylent Green. So I think things...
It's kind of bizarre, isn't it, really? Why don't they just call it falafel or something like that? You know, why do you have to make fake meat? There's plenty of good vegan food around. But I must say that I went to a vegan restaurant once and it was supposed to be the thing. And I've got to tell you, it was all misery food. It was bloody hard work.
I tell you what, John, right? Next time you're in Canberra, go to...
Oh, you're going to take him to... Is that the place that has the cheese stuff, though?
It used to sell meat, but then in COVID, they changed it to a vegetarian restaurant. I'll tell you what, it's actually pretty good. Like, it's very good. Great cocktails. But what they've done with it is basically everything is just stuffed with cheese. So...
It's a vegetarian restaurant. Oh, well, so you're allowed to eat cheese.
Vegetarian, I can live with.
And it's fantastic.
If it couldn't have cheese, life wouldn't be worth living.
No. And, you know, obviously salami and stuff that's vegetarian because it's processed. So, and spices, it's mainly spices. So, should be right.
So I'll hold you to that, by the way.
Yeah. We'll put it on the NFF account. what, Murray Watt, yeah? Like, we've met Murray Watt recently. He said he's going to come on the podcast at some point, but he's just very busy.
We bumped into Murray at Farmer of the Year Award, the Weekly Times one.
Yep.
Had a good chat as we were going into the MCG.
Yep. So...
Very good.
How do you think he's doing in the role? What do you think? What do you think? Like, we know the bad things he's done or the things that you think is bad. What do you think is the best thing he's done in his 18 months or 2 years in the position?
Well, I think the very fact that he listened to us right at the word go with regards to the methane and just came out, you know, blanket, instant response was, we're not going to do that to our farmers. That's standing up for agriculture, which is what I think, you know, ag ministers are meant to do. You know, they should be promoting. And look, if he's going to put money into abattoirs and that sort of thing, I think that's fantastic. You know, if that's about developing the capacity onshore, that's fantastic. And, you know, as I said, if that caused the trade to phase out in its own right because of an economic imperative, no one would have a problem with that. And I think, you know, that would make a good ag minister. That would make a very good ag minister. But doing it by shutting down the trade via, legislation is quite adverse to good agricultural policy. And the biosecurity tax is another one. You know, I think, you know, he could have done that a lot better if he just imposed it on a container levy and raised that $50 million that way. It would have been a good thing. So, look, he has done some good things, make no mistake. I think, you know, putting money into the fire ants is pretty fantastic and absolutely necessary. You know, biosecurity, increasing the biosecurity spend, you know, absolutely necessary. You know, give the man kudos where he deserves it. And I think, you know, fighting the varroa mite as much as they did, and unfortunately they've decided to let it go, I think that was pretty important. But biosecurity is probably our biggest one. It's just the way they're funding it against farmers, which is a bit of a problem.
What
about the EID tags? That was one of the big early things that Murray brought in. What's your views on the EIDs?
Well, that's about biosecurity as well. And, you know, it's unfortunate. You know, look, if sheep was still worth $200 in Western Australia, I think people would go, well, no big deal. Yeah, you know, it's a bit over a dollar. But, you know, we're struggling to get, you know, some people are getting 50 cents for their sheep in the sale yards in Katanning.
Tags worth more than the sheep.
Tags worth more than the sheep. Well, in fact, it's costing people $5 to get the sheep there, $5 for yardage, $2 for the tag, and they get 50 cents for the sheep. You know, it's a pretty bloody quick sum for going broke very quickly. You know, I think, you know, we were just having the discussions yesterday about putting less crop in to be able to manage the sheep that we haven't been able to turn off.
Do you think, because obviously Murray Watt's Minister of Agriculture, but he's also Emergency Services Minister, do you think that's, in today's day and age, with the types of things we're seeing, you know, we've had heaps of cyclones this season, we've had flooding, we've had fires in several parts. You guys have had another fire outbreak again just yesterday or so, wasn't it, in WA. So is there too much in both of those things to have just one person covering off on all of it? Should we have just a dedicated ag minister and have another separate minister to worry about the emergency services stuff separately?
Oh, look, I can see no reason why Murray shouldn't be able to handle both of them. He's been conspicuously quiet on the agriculture front lately, which is a bit disappointing. But, you know, we've got to put the emergency services stuff in perspective as well. The number of people who are killed by emergencies or natural disasters in the world over the last 100 years in actual figures is less than 5% of what it was 100 years ago. So in terms of the world population, it's a massive decline. So, you know, let's put emergency services in perspective here. We've got a much higher expectation of being able to survive those things, and rightly so. So, you know, he's really only the spokesman for it. He shouldn't be getting actively involved. I think that he should be able to handle them both. He's a pretty intelligent man. Just his ideologies are a bit stuffed.
Righto. I think we've
I've never heard you speechless before, Andrew.
I thought you were going to ask another question there.
No, I thought you were.
No.
I'm trying to think. There was something else that we had. What was it we were going to discuss, Matt? I think we probably discussed everything we decided to put down.
I think so.
It's been a very wide-ranging discussion, actually. I've enjoyed it. We've talked about it.
The WAF conference.
ESG. We talked about climate, live trade. WAF conference. You've got to stop calling it WAF, Andrew.
Oh, yeah. WA Farmers. Sorry, it's because I'm old. Because I'm old school, remember? Do you know? John, as one president to another, as the inaugural Ag Connect's first president, it's good to have us chatting about things. I can give you some advice. How is
Ag Connect? Give me some advice how to make Ag Connect work well.
No, I was curious about, like, how is Ag Connect going? Like, because I've always believed that, like, these SFOs need to, like, let's be honest, you joked about it before we came on a podcast, the descriptions that you often get told that you are. I'm not going to say it. Yes. You can say it.
Oh, okay. I'm a bald, fat, blind, deaf, grey, grumpy, fat, white guy.
Oh, you forgot old, John.
Old.
Oh, yeah.
And heterosexual.
Well, next month, I'll be out.
Very
different.
But that is, like, when you go to a state farm organization, that is the majority of the audience. It's of that description. And I've always believed that it's, in order for these SFOs to last in the long term, we need to get young people into these sort of, and get them interested and engaged. New South Wales Farmers doing quite a bit. Like Martin Murray is, I think he's the president of the New South Wales Farmers, Young Farmers, somewhere or other. They used to be born in VFF, but I don't think that exists anymore. Like a Young Farmers, YAPS, I think it was called, or YIPS. But AdConnect has been around for about 10 years. But how is it working in terms of getting people from AdConnect into like the big boys table, I guess?
Well, I mean, she was one of the exporters, but one of our of the boat, the Bahija, and I've got a bit of an opinion on that if you want to hear it shortly. But
All right.
she stepped up really well into our livestock council. In fact, a lot of our livestock council are very young people, and certainly some of our grains council are very young people. And I think that's very exciting. And Josh Fuschbichler, who was on AgConnect, is now in the grains council. I think that's very exciting that these people have stepped up. You're not going to get everybody, and I think it's really good that some of the young people who are in the livestock council are actually out of industry rather than out of farming, which is a really bloody good thing. And if we can bring people on like that, that's really good. The important thing is to engage with them, and it should be a social thing as well. We tend to have a lot of these meetings and then jump on a plane and go instead of socializing. I think it's really important, like I try to do with you guys on a regular, is have a red or a beer together and have a chat, because I think
Some
those things are really important.
vegan snacks and
There's some vegan haggis, mate. So we can, I think we've got to make it about social as well. And, that's imp I think AgConnect's doing that pretty well. And it's always a challenge trying to get people, because it's, when I left school, there were 15,000 farmers delivering to CBH. Now they're about 3,500. That's a massive decline in actual farmers. Farming businesses, still a lot of people out here, but it's an actual decline in farming businesses. So we need to view it, I think, as a whole industry, agribusiness as an industry rather than
Hundred
just
percent.
farming, because it's a massive industry. And as I said before, if you didn't have agriculture, then our economy would be a lot smaller than it is now, and you wouldn't have the number of people in Australia as what we do, because you wouldn't be able to feed them.
I agree, because I think sometimes there can be an animosity between farmers and further down the supply chain. But the reality is everyone is aiming, and most of the people in the supply chain come from agriculture anyway. Like most of the people that work as livestock agents or grain merchants or whoever else are probably coming from a farm anyway. So getting a different perspective, not just the farmer's perspective, because any of these things impact a whole supply chain, any government policy. So that's why I've always viewed it. Like AgConnect was good because it was industry and obviously farmers. And Matt and I are no, we're no longer farmers because we retired from farming.
Yeah, made all the money we could make, and now we're out.
Now we're out,
I'm just tired. I'm not retired.
but we still obviously got an interest in the industry because that's where we live and breathe it. You mentioned that boat, the Bahija, is that how it's pronounced?
Oh, yeah, the Bahija, yep.
Tell us about it.
Okay, so it's a pretty sordid tale, really. The exporter, when they export the livestock in the first place, have to have a contingency plan. And they had that contingency plan. It was, if it gets to the Red Sea, they turn around and go around via the Cape. Now, that's all very well. So they had the contingency plan, and the Australian regulators then imposed a further imposition upon the exporters by saying, well, what's your contingency plan now? What, because the animal activists got an action going in Israel, they started being, instead of being concerned about animal welfare and biosecurity, which is the only two things they needed to be worried about, they decided to get themselves involved in what was going on politically in Israel with regards to the ship being unloaded. So they then turned around and said, well, what happens if you can't get it unloaded? That really wasn't their concern. I think the exporters knew they'd get it unloaded, and it's probably being unloaded right now as we speak. But so the department has then told them to turn around and come home. Now, they couldn't even tell us, when the boat was 2 days out from Fremantle, what their preferred course of action was. And so I said to them, this is an industry meeting on a Sunday after doing our acknowledgement of country. They said, well, we don't know what our preferred course of action is. And I said, well, from my perspective, our preferred course of action is to reload the vessel, turn around, and set sail straight away. Now, it took another 4 days for them to actually come out and say that was their preferred course of action. Why did it take so long? They weren't thinking about what was going on. They were covering their, this is my opinion, they were covering their bloody asses. They were too shit scared to make a decision. They were paralyzed with fear about what the outcomes could be. They should have just been saying, these are our two issues, biosecurity, animal welfare, they're all good, set sail again. It was a fuck up.
You didn't sugarcoat it there, John. But do you think, How much do you think that impacts the view of Australia as a trading partner for these potential clients?
Pardon me. Well, I can assure you, I'm sure they wouldn't have been happy. They wouldn't have been happy. I'm looking out the window because I've got a livestock. I mean, a truck turning up to take some sheep away, which is pretty rare at the moment. It's very hard to turn livestock off. I think it's impacted us pretty badly in terms of it was not a good look. Even though the livestock came off the ship in far better nick than they went on, even though they had to reduce the numbers drastically because they were too fat to fit so many back on. They had to drop off 600 out of 1,200 cattle so they could fit all the livestock back on. Even though I think the department made a massive mistake in shooting a number of sheep rather than have them set sail because they had health issues. They couldn't, and they weren't really bad health issues, by the way. They could have cut them up and fed them to the people of Fremantle. There were so many things that were done so badly, but in terms of the visual to the Australian public, not good. But the outcome to the exporter, they finally got them to where they wanted to go to in far better nick than they ever went.
It's been, it
I
was
think
it, it was interesting just seeing, like, we obviously have the ship tracker and we're tracking the vessel back and forth and back and forth. It was pretty interesting to see, like, how long it took. And because what I found most interesting about it was people complaining about the biosecurity risk of it, of unloading the sheep back in Australia, which, to be honest, I didn't think was a major issue because we clean those vessels thoroughly before they're loaded. And so I always worry that when some arguments might sound good, but that is an argument that can be used to shut down the live export industry. If we as farmers are saying, oh, there's too much of a biosecurity risk, well, if I was Jimmy in animal rights organization, I'd be saying, well, every vessel coming from now on to load sheep or cattle is a risk, because those vessels are disinfected prior to arriving in Australia. So, and that vessel hadn't touched land, so biosecurity risk was minimal, if zero, I would have thought.
The biggest
Oh,
issue.
in fact, I think that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
It was low.
The biggest issue I thought was, like you said, John, that from the time they decided to turn the ship around and bring it back, there was ample time to make a decision as to what was going to happen once they got into port. And the delays there were just questionable. But as you said, I think you've got your truck arriving and we've taken up a lot of your time already, John. So I think we might have to call it a day here.
And I suppose the only reason I was mentioned above conference is I think that Matt and I are at that conference
We
again,
are. Mm-hmm.
doing something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what we're doing yet, but that's in June, I believe.
I know it'll be preceded by a bottle of red between the three of us, but or Scotch. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. Yes, and unfortunately it'll be a bit cold over here in June, but it'll be a good conference. And I think there's a lot of issues to be discussed, and you guys are in the two major areas that we operate in as WA farmers. So I look forward to having you.
Should be good
That
fun.
sounds good. No, we're good to see you.
I think we've done a WAF conference for the last 4 years in a row, maybe five. So maybe we should get, like, I'm not saying, John, like, you've got a bit of sway as a president, but maybe they're in. I know that you do the evening event and there's all sorts of awards, but maybe an award could be swung,
Lifetime achievement awards.
Lifetime Achievement Award or something. Order of Australia, something like that, knighthood. I don't know. It's just something,
Sir Andrew. Sir Andrew.
Oh, there you go. All right, it's getting silly now. Thanks for coming on, John. It's been great to have a chat.
That was actually a serious one. But anyway, that was probably the most serious part of the conversation is making sure we get some form of award for our services to agriculture.
I think if you
Cash
keep
for awards, you get it
asking,
every day.
yeah, if you keep asking for awards, it lessens the value of the award. If you're
Not
gonna not ask.
for me.
All right, no worries.
I've got no pride. Jeez.
All
Righto,
right.
John. Thanks for coming along. And it's
Thank you very much, fella.
6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. No,
And
excellent. We'll
all right, I've
see you.
enjoyed that. Thank
We'll
you.
see you when you got nothing on, John.
Ciao for now.